Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and get an update on the G20 summit in Cannes from a specialist on European economies, Amy Verdun, the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. We will discuss the day's activities that were overshadowed by the Greek crisis provoked by a call for a referendum that the Greek Prime Minister has since retracted. Then we'll examine the latest rumors of war about the long-standing possibility that Israel will attack Iran, as well as recent signals that the United States might attack Iran next year. Investigative journalist Robert Dreyfus joins us to examine these rumors, which he disputes in an article currently in The Nation. But we will explore these scenarios as tensions have been recently heightened over an assassination plot and a forthcoming report from the IAEA about Iran's nuclear program. Then, to get another perspective on these rumors of war, we will speak with Richard Sale, who has reported on intelligence since the 1970s and has an article at Truthout, U.S. and Israeli tech teams develop Malworm to take down Iran's computer software. We will discuss the extent to which sabotage has slowed the Iranian nuclear program and why a military attack would be necessary, not to mention disastrous and counterproductive. Joining us now is Amy Verdun, who's a professor and chair of political science at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. Her books include European Response to Globalization and Financial Market Integration, Globalization, Development and Integration, and her latest, Ruling Europe, The Politics of the Stability and Growth Pact. She is also co-editor of the Journal of Common Market Studies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Amy Verdun.
Hi, Ian.
And you are in Europe as the G20 summit takes place in Cannes. And at this point, of course, prior to this, a deal was made. Merkel and Sarkozy managed to make the bankers take a 50% haircut on their Greek debt. And then suddenly, a few days later, this deal is blown up by a grenade tossed into the works by the Greek Prime Minister, who called for a referendum. And he, of course, he's facing a no-confidence vote. He has reversed himself on the referendum and is trying to work out some kind of a deal with the opposition, however unlikely that is. But in the meantime, of course, just those simple actions of his, perhaps, you know, out of his political selfishness, caused the price of Italian debt to go up and the price of Portuguese, Irish and Spanish debt as well. And, of course, brought down a brokerage house here in the United States run by former governor of New Jersey, Corzine. So quite a lot of wreckage has been done so far. So, any good news from today's activities?
It's interesting you should put it all in that long list. Indeed, I think it was one of the most turbulent days we've seen in international politics in a long time. I think people were a bit upset because the Greek Prime Minister decided this without consulting with anybody. There was some leakage today that suggested he may have spoken to somebody and that they may have heard about it, but that was quickly withdrawn. So the big issue here was that he put this referendum to the people without consulting his partners. The reason why the partners were upset about this is because they would have never been making that a deal on the 26th of October to help the Greeks out with the haircut and the package and expanding the European Financial Stability Fund if they had known that he would put it to a referendum. The whole point of last week was to make sure that there was some stability and calmness in the market. There was a lot of jittering in that week about what could Europe do, and they were extremely pleased with themselves when they managed to get the package arranged, and it still needed to be sold to a lot of people, whether it was the right amount, whether it was the right type of package, were the details right. So just having the Greek Prime Minister wreaking havoc with all that by putting a referendum to the people was what made people very upset.
But I suppose politicians, it may be too much to ask for them to have more altruistic and global views than their own parochial interests. And even our own leader, President Obama, is there at the G20, I think, motivated largely, because he doesn't want the European economy to drag down the American economy, which is already a millstone around his neck.
Yes. It's interesting. I think the whole situation here must really be seen from a sort of a two-level game situation. In political science, we often speak about what people do, politicians, that is, at the domestic level and at the international level. And this referendum was really intended to be domestic. It wasn't intended to be, let's wreak havoc with the international markets. Of course, he should have known that this would have worked out this way, but I don't think he could have been thinking it through and realizing what the international community and the international markets would have done with his referendum. I think it's not as selfish as you make it out to be. The Greek Prime Minister was in a very, very difficult position. He has a very slim majority in his parliament, and he needs the support of the opposition in order to put through the reforms that will be needed in order to make that financial package that the people have made available to the Greeks to make that possible. And that will mean cutting a lot of public sector jobs. It will be cutting wages, cutting pensions, a lot of reforms that the Greeks haven't really got their heads around. A lot of simple day-to-day Greeks think that the crisis was caused by their elites, and they think that the elites should just solve it. In order to make this package a success, he needs a buy-in from basically everybody. He needs a buy-in from the opposition, and he needs a buy-in from the people. So in his view, by putting it to a referendum, he would be able to get the buy-in from the people. It was, however, very quickly clear that the referendum would end up being a referendum that officially says it's about this or that. You know, do you want the bailout package? Are you willing to prepare for this? I mean, the question had not really been determined. But it would very likely be a popularity contest on his leadership, which he would most likely lose. So without even knowing what the details was of the bailouts and how much it would cost everybody, the information within a day was this referendum is going to be negative. And, of course, that was going to be a real problem, because then there is more havoc in the markets for, you know, 4 weeks or however long it would be for them to organize the referendum. So the situation today that I thought was pretty exciting was not just the sort of the hour-by-hour unwinding of this whole story, but that eventually the conservative opposition realized that if this referendum were to go forward, Greeks might have to leave the euro, and that the whole situation could be escalating out of control. So it was the opposition coming to the rescue of the prime minister by saying, okay, we will support this, that made the Greek prime minister decide that at this point he'll withdraw the referendum. Arguably, he got a lot of heat from the international partners in other places in Europe, so that he may have realized that this is just not the way to go.
Again, I'm speaking with Amy Van Dunn, who's a professor and chair of political science at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. She's in Europe at the moment. We're talking about the G20 conference going on in Cannes, and the less political and more theatrical aspects of it, Amy, are, of course, that the world's second richest person, Bill Gates, is there, along with a group of American nurses, and the British actor Bill Nighy, who did a videotape where he played a selfish banker that went viral. He apparently appeared in a bed that the nurses put out to symbolize the global economy, but, of course, the nurses were saying that they don't leave any sick person behind, and we're appealing for the G20 leaders to show concern for the third world, if you will. Apparently, that was Sarkozy's original idea in hosting this conference, that they'd actually be talking about how the richer nations can help the poorer nations. But clearly, the crisis within the Eurozone, precipitated by Greece, has stolen taken the oxygen out of that, hasn't it?
Yes, I think this is a situation that looks a little bit more, if you like, a kamikaze compared to your day-to-day politics. This was a real crazy day with all of these activities going on.
And what explains, though, Amy Van Dunn, the fact that the politicians have, obviously the markets move a lot faster than the politicians do, and with the European Parliament having so many different voices that have to come to consensus, one understands why it is difficult, but still it's hard to understand how this crisis has gone on for so long, for years in fact. And as it is prolonged, the price of getting out of it goes up. They could have settled this surely a year or even two ago for pennies on the dollar.
Yeah. It's one of those things that keeps amazing observers on the whole European crisis. The background to why it wasn't solved earlier is found in Germany. The German leaders, when agreeing to monetary union with countries that were traditionally those who were easily choosing a devaluation route to remain competitive, felt that such a monetary union would require strict rules and no bailout of any countries. And that was written down in the treaty that everybody signed up on. So when this came by and it looked like the Greeks had cooked the books and their budgetary deficit was way higher than anybody had seen coming because of statistical misrepresentation of the deficit, the Germans were just in no state of mind to say, oh, yeah, that's no problem, let's bail you out, because that would have been completely contrary to the situation that they had signed up on. So it took them a good number of months, in fact, you could argue years at this point, to realize that they're shooting themselves in the foot by not accepting that this is a political responsibility after having taken those economic steps to integrate Europe's single market with a single currency. And I think that's the lesson that comes out of all of this. If you were to ask those around the table, Sarkozy, Merkel, I mean, if you could settle this a year and a half ago for this price, they would have settled long time ago, but they had no idea it was escalating out of control. Another element that comes out when you say, you know, how can they not settle this and why does it keep on spinning out of control, is that there are a lot of veto players. And the design of economic and monetary union at this time has only one element of the whole economic and monetary union at the supranational level, and that is the central bank. The European Central Bank is a supranational institution that could speak with one voice and is governed by one institution, and it's very clear who's in charge and what happens there. The other side of that, in most monetary unions, you have on the one hand this monetary authority, central bank, on the other hand this sort of fiscal authority, the sort of tax and spend authority. In the United States, it's a treasury, in federal jurisdictions, it's a government, a voted into power government that taxes and spends. And in the EU context, that authority is decentralized. So it is the national member states governments that tax and spend, and the system of coordination between this central bank on the one hand and these 27 fiscal authorities in the European Union and 17 in monetary union are decentralized. And the way to keep this coordinated is by a set of rules. Now, these rules have been undermined in various steps throughout the last couple of years, but the idea was that by agreeing to those rules, you would be able to coordinate without having to transfer sovereignty to a higher level. And this whole crisis shows that there's a flaw in the design, because as long as one of these countries can basically not stick to the rules, it could undermine the entire euro. And we saw that recently in one of the other Central and Eastern European countries, where the opposition just basically says, we don't support this. And so there seem to be a lot of veto players, a lot of national parliaments that can say, we don't like this, and now we're going to vote against. That makes people very worried.
And Amy Verdun, the proposals that were put forth apparently by Bill Gates, the world's second richest person, who was invited there by Sarkozy to talk about what was supposed to be the original agenda before the Greek grenade blew that up. He apparently, Gates's proposal, or at least a part of his proposal, is that, and this was designed for the rich countries to raise money to take care of the poor countries, he argues that a small tax on trades of stocks, derivatives, and other financial instruments, known as a financial transaction tax or a Wall Street speculation tax or more commonly known as a Robin Hood tax, apparently already 15 of the G20 countries have some form of securities transaction tax, but the United States certainly doesn't have it. And I can guarantee you that the banking lobby here in this country, the Wall Street lobby, will fight it tooth and nail. What's your sense of how that could get some traction?
Yeah. Bill Gates' Robin Hood tax. I think it is a very interesting point of departure because it comes from a very wealthy American. We've had many calls for a Tobin tax, the same idea. It's an economist, Tobin, who said that you should just tax transactions. Typically, that will only work if you have some kind of world governance. If there is a market out there that does not do it, people say some of the transactions will simply go to that market. The European Union has been responding to the crisis in the early months by saying the European Union would regulate some kind of taxation on these kinds of transactions, only to discover that at least one country somewhere will say, well, then the market is going to move somewhere else. So these issues are very helpful as an idea of who you would tax in order to move some of the money from those who have a lot to those who don't have a lot. But it is a difficult thing to implement unless you get a lot of buy-in from many countries. So in a sense, by putting it at the G20 and by asking all the large leaders to participate, that would be the right place to do it. Because by just asking some of the individual countries to start doing this, it won't work in something so mobile as capital.
So just in closing, Amy Verdun, what this has clearly, this crisis or these series of crises that have dragged on for so long that have made the European experiment look like it doesn't have its act together, to say the least. Obviously, it's at an important crossroads, particularly if Greece leaves and defaults, that could lead to others doing the same into the end of the euro. Sarkozy and Merkel have been adamant, saying they don't want that. But what can be done then to, one, fix this situation, and two, make sure it doesn't happen again, and in fact, make the European experiment more robust and more enduring?
It's one of those questions that has made this crisis very difficult. When we had economic and monetary union being designed, many observers said this will only work as long as the economic tide is positive. When there is a crisis, this will come to the fore, and the European Union will have to decide whether it will be further integrating in the areas of political and fiscal integration, or whether it wants to move back or deal with some of the problems of not having the full set of tools. And people didn't quite understand what that meant or what it would look like if it were not completely integrated, and I think that's now on the table. And any institutional change in Europe is typically slow, and one of the reasons why this has dragged on is it takes the Europeans some time to make decisions. Any such institutional changes to go through 27 member states, and they have to be ratified. In some cases, it requires a referendum. So they don't make major institutional changes to the structure of the European Union very easily or lightly. This will change. They will need to decide what kind of Europe do they want. They may need to make stricter rules, and they've got a number of proposals on the table, a so-called six-pack is on the table, to make sure that there's a bit more control over budgetary situation in member states. But it will take a little bit more time, and then they might have made those design changes so that they'll be a bit more able to deal with countries who are not complying with the rules originally set out to support the whole economic and monetary union.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Amy Verdun.
My pleasure. Thanks for asking me to
come. And thank you for staying up so late. Again, I've been speaking with Amy Verdun, who's professor and chair of political science at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. Her books include European Responses to Globalization and Financial Market Integration, Globalization, Development and Integration, and her latest, Ruling Europe, The Politics of the Stability and Growth Pact. She's also co-editor of the Journal of Common Market Studies. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about whether or not Israel will attack Iran or the United States will attack Iran.
Banks fall, presidents grabbing his hand, the economy down, Wall Street about to lose their mind, up and down, gas prices up and down, nobody knows what to do. You know what we need, though?